Chapter 40. Dawn was coming up, painting the eastern sky a delicate rose color. Stu Redman and Glenn Bateman were about halfway up Flagstaff Mountain in West Boulder, where the first foothills of the Rockies rise up out of the flat plains like a vision of prehistory. In the dawn light, Stu thought that the pines crawling between the naked and nearly perpendicular stone faces looked like the veins ridging some giant's hand that had poked out of the earth. "I'm going to have a headache this afternoon," Glenn said. "I don't believe I've stayed up drinking all night since I was an undergrad." "Sunrise is worth it," Stu said. "Yes, it is. Beautiful." Stu hoisted the jug of wine and had a swallow. "I got quite a buzz on myself." He looked out over the view in silence for a few moments, and then turned to Glenn with a slanted smile. "What's going to happen now?"
"Happen?
Sure. That's why I got you up here. Told Franny I'm going to get him good and drunk and then pick his brains. She said fine." Glenn grinned. "There are no tea leaves in the bottom of a wine bottle. So make some educated guesses. Cross my palm with silver, O aspirant to knowledge." "Never mind the silver, Baldy. I'll take you down to the First National Bank of Boulder tomorrow and give you $1 million. How's that?" "Seriously, Stu, what do you want to know?" "Same things that mute guy Andros wants to know, I guess. What's going to happen next? I don't know how to put it any better than that." "There's going to be a society," Glenn said slowly. "What kind? Impossible to say right now. There are almost 400 people here now. I'd guess from the rate they've been coming in, more every day, that by the 1st of September there'll be 1,500 of us, 4,500 by the 1st of October, and maybe as many as 8,000 by the time the snow flies in November and closes the roads. Write that down as prediction number one." "Hard for me to believe," Stu said. "We came all the way across the country and didn't see 100 people all told. Ralph's in touch with 5 or 6 groups right now that will bring us up to 500 by the end of the week," Glenn said, and smiled again. "Mother Abigail sits right there with him in his radio station, but she won't talk on the CB. Says she's afraid she'll get an electroshock." "Franny loves that old woman," Stu said. "Part of it is because she knows so much about delivering babies, but part of it is just loving her, you know? Yes, most everybody feels the same." 8,000 people by winter," Stu said. "Man, oh man. It's just arithmetic. Let's say the flu wiped out 99% of the population. Maybe it wasn't that bad, but let's use that figure just so we have a place to put our feet. If the flu was 99% fatal, that means it wiped out damn near 218 million people just in this country." He looked at Stu's shocked face and nodded grimly. "Maybe it wasn't that bad, but we can make a pretty good guess that figure's in the ballpark. Makes the Nazis look like pikers, doesn't it?" "My lord," Stu said in a dry voice. "But that would still leave over 2 million people, 1/5 of the pre-plague population of Tokyo, 1/4 of the pre-plague population of New York. That's in this country alone. Now, I believe that 10% of that 2 million might not have survived the aftermath of the flu. People like poor Mark Braddock with his burst appendix, but also the accidents, the suicides, yes, and murder, too. That takes us down to 1.8 million. But we suspect there's an adversary, don't we? The dark man that we dreamed about. West of us, somewhere. There are 7 states over there that could legitimately be called his territory, if he really exists." "I guess he exists all right," Stu said. "My feeling, too. But is he simply in dominion of all the people over there? I don't think so. Any more than Mother Abigail is automatically in dominion of the people in the other 41 continental United States. I think things have been in a state of slow flux. That state of affairs is beginning to end. People are cohering. When you and I first discussed this back in New Hampshire, I envisioned dozens of little tin pot societies. What I didn't count on, because I didn't know about it, was the all but irresistible pull of these 2 opposing dreams. Was a new fact that no one could have foreseen. Are you saying that we'll end up with 900,000 people and he'll end up with 900,000? No. First, the coming winter is going to take its toll. It's going to take it here. It's going to be even tougher for the small groups that don't make it here before the snow. You realize we don't even have one doctor in the free zone yet. Our medical staff consists of a veterinarian and Mother Abigail herself, who's forgotten more valid folk medicine than you or I will ever have a chance to learn. Still, they'd look cute trying to put a steel plate in your skull after you took a fall and bashed in the back of your head, wouldn't they? Stu snickered. That old boy Rolf Danamont would probably drag out his Remington and let daylight through me. I'd guess the total American population might be down to 1.6 million by next spring, and that's a kind estimate. Of that number, I'd like to hope we get the million. Boulder couldn't hold them. I know that boggles the mind when you walk around the empty streets downtown and out toward Table Mesa, but it just couldn't. We'd have to seed the communities all around us. The situation you'd have is this one giant community and the rest of the country east of here absolutely empty. Why do you think we'd get most of the people? For a very unscientific reason, Glenn said, riffling his tonsure of hair with one hand. I'd like to believe most people are good, and I believe that whoever is running the show west of us is really bad. But I have a hunch, he trailed off. Go on, spill it. I will because I'm drunk, but it stays between us, Stuart. All right. Your word? My word, Stu said. I think he's going to get most of the techies, Glenn said finally. Don't ask me why, it's just a hunch. Except that tech people like to work in an atmosphere of tight discipline and linear goals, for the most part. They like it when the trains run on time. What we've got here in Boulder right now is mass confusion, everyone bopping along and doing his own thing. And we've got to do something about what my students would have called getting our shit together. But that other fellow, I'll bet he's got the trains running on time and all his ducks in a row. And techies are just as human as the rest of us. They'll go where they're wanted the most. I've a suspicion that our adversary wants as many as he can get. Fuck the farmers, he'd just as soon have a few men who can dust off those Idaho missile silos and get them operational again. Ditto tanks and helicopters and maybe a B-52 bomber or two just for chuckles. Right now he's probably still concentrating on getting the power back on, re-establishing communications. Maybe he's had to indulge in a purge or two. Rome wasn't built in a day, and he'll know that. He has time. But when I watch the sun go down at night, and this is no shit, Stuart, I get scared. I don't need bad dreams to scare me anymore. All I have to do is think of them over there on the other side of the Rockies, busy as little bees. What should we be doing? Should I give you a list? Glenn responded, grinning. Stuart took down a battered notebook with two disco dancers and the words Boogie Down on its hot pink cover. Yep, he said. You're kidding. No, I ain't. You said it, Glenn. We gotta start getting our shit together someplace. I feel it, too. It's getting later every day. We can't just sit here jacking off and listen to the CB. We may wake up some morning to find that hard case waltzing into Boulder at the head of an armored column, complete with air support. Don't look for him tomorrow, Glenn said. No. What about next May? Possibly, Glenn said in a low voice. Yes, quite possibly. And what do you think would happen to us? Glenn didn't reply with words. He made an explicit little trigger-pulling gesture with the forefinger of his right hand, and then hurriedly scoffed the last of the wine. Yeah, Stu said. So let's start getting it together. Talk. Glenn closed his eyes. The brightening day touched his wrinkled cheeks and forehead. Okay, he said. Here it is, Stu. First, recreate America. Little America. By fair means and by foul. Organization and government come first. If it starts now, we can form the sort of government we want. If we wait until the population triples, we're going to have grave problems. Let's say we call a meeting a week from today. That would make it August 18th. Everyone to attend. Before the meeting, there should be an ad hoc organization committee. A committee of seven, let us say. You, me, Andros, Fran, Harold Lauder, maybe. A couple more. The job of the committee would be to create an agenda for the August 18th meeting. And I can tell you right now what some of the items on that agenda should be. Shoot. First, reading and ratification of the Declaration of Independence. Second, R&R of the Constitution. Third, R&R of the Bill of Rights. All ratification to be done by voice vote. Christ, Glenn, we're all Americans. No, that's where you're wrong, Glenn said, opening his eyes. We're a bunch of survivors with no government at all, from every age group, religious group, class group, and racial group. What we've got going for us now is culture lag. Most of these people will still believe in government by representation, the republic, what they think of as democracy. But culture lag never lasts long. After a while, they'll wake up to the idea that the old ways are gone, and that they can restructure society any old way they want. We want, we need, to catch them before they wake up and do something nutty. He leveled his finger at Stu. If someone stood up at that August 18th meeting and proposed that Mother Abigail be put in absolute charge, with you and me and that fellow Andros as her advisors, those people would pass the item by acclamation, blissfully unaware that they had just voted the first operating American dictatorship into power since Huey Long. Oh, I can't believe that. There are college graduates here, lawyers, political activists. Maybe they used to be. Now they're just a bunch of tired, scared people who don't know what's going to happen to them. Some might squawk, but they'd shut up when you told them that Mother Abigail and her advisors were going to get the power back on in 60 days. No, Stu, it's very important that the first thing we do is ratify the spirit of the old society. That's what I meant about recreating America. It has to be that way as long as we're operating under direct threat of the man we're calling the adversary. Go on. All right. The next item on the agenda would be that we run the government like a New England township. Perfect democracy. As long as we're relatively small, it'll work fine. Instead of a board of selectmen, we'll have seven, representatives, I guess. And we'll see to it that the people who get elected are the same people who were on the ad hoc committee. We'll put the rush on everybody and get the vote taken before people can do any tub-thumping for their friends. We can handpick people to nominate us and then second us. The vote will go through as slick as shit through a goose. That's neat, Stu said admiringly. Sure, Glenn said glumly. If you want to short-circuit the democratic process, ask a sociologist. What next? Well, this is going to be very popular. The item would read, Resolved, Mother Abigail is to be given absolute veto power over any action proposed by the board. Jesus, will she agree to that? I think so. But I don't think she'll ever be apt to exercise her veto power, not in any circumstances I can foresee. We just can't expect to have a workable government here unless we make her its titular head. She's the thing we all have in common. We've all had a paranormal experience that revolves around her, and she has a kind of aura about her. People all use the same loose bunch of adjectives to describe her. Good, kind, old, wise, clever, nice. These people have had one dream that frightens the bejesus out of them, and one that makes them feel safe and secure. They love and trust the source of the good dream all the more because of the dream that frightened them. And we can make it clear to her that she's our leader in name only. I think that's how she'd want it. She's old, tired. Stu was shaking his head. She's old and tired, but she sees this problem of the dark man as a religious crusade, Glenn. You know that. You mean she might decide to take the bit in her teeth? Maybe that wouldn't be so bad, Stu remarked. After all, it was her we dreamed of, not a representative board. Glenn was shaking his head. No, I can't accept the idea that we're all pawns in some post-apocalypse game of good and evil. Dreams are not. God damn it, it's irrational. Stu shrugged. Well, let's not get bogged down in it now. I think your idea of giving her veto power is a good one. In fact, I don't think it goes far enough. We ought to give her the power to propose as well as dispose. Not absolute power on that side of the slate, Glenn said hastily. No, her ideas would have to be ratified by the representative board, Stu said, and then added, We might find ourselves a rubber stamp for her instead of the other way around. There was a long silence. Glenn had put his forehead into one hand. At last he said, "Yeah, you're right. She can't just be a figurehead. At the very least, we have to accept the possibility that she may have her own ideas. And that's where I pack up my cloudy crystal ball, East Texas, because she's what those of us who ride the sociology range call other-directed." "Who's the other?" "It doesn't matter. What it means is that what she says won't necessarily be dictated by what this society needs or by what its mores turn out to be. She'll be listening to some other voice, like Joan of Arc. What you've made me see is that we just might wind up with a theocracy on our hands here."
Theoc what?"
"On a god trip," Glenn said. He didn't sound too happy about it. "When you were a little boy, Stu, did you ever dream that you might grow up to be one of 7 high priests and or priestesses to a 108-year-old black woman from Nebraska?" Stu stared at him. Finally, he said, "Is there any more of that wine?"
"All gone."
"Shit." "Yes," Glenn said. They studied each other's faces in silence, and then suddenly burst out laughing. It was surely the nicest house Mother Abigail had ever lived in, and sitting here on the screened-in porch put her in mind of a traveling salesman who had come around Hemmingford back in 1936 or 37. Why, he'd been the sweetest-talking fellow she'd ever met in her life. He could have charmed the birdies right down from the trees. She had asked this young man, Mr. Donald King by name, what his business was with Abby Freemantle, and he had replied, "My business, ma'am, is pleasure. Your pleasure. Do you like to read? Listen to the radio, perchance? Or maybe just put your tired old dogs up on a foot hassock and listen to the world as it rolls down the great bowling alley of the universe?" She had admitted she enjoyed all those things, not admitting that the Motorola had been sold a month before to pay for 90 bales of hay. "Well, those are the things I'm selling," this sweet talker told her. "It may be called an Electrolux vacuum cleaner complete with all the attachments, but what it really is spare time. Plug her in and you open up whole new vistas of relaxation for yourself, and the payments are almost as easy as your housework's going to be." They had been deep in the Depression then, and she hadn't even been able to raise 20 cents for hair ribbons for her granddaughter's birthdays, and there was no chance for that Electrolux. But say, didn't that Mr. Donald King of Peru, Indiana, talk sweet? My! She had never seen him again, but she had never forgotten his name either. She just bet he had gone on to break some white lady's heart. She never did own a vacuum cleaner until the end of the Nazi War, when it seemed like all of a sudden anybody could afford anything, and even poor white trash had a Mercury hidden away in their back shed. Now this house, in the Mapleton section of Boulder, Mother Abigail just bet there hadn't been many blacks living up here before the smiting plague, had every gadget she'd ever heard of, and some she hadn't. Dishwasher, 2 vacuums, one strictly for the upstairs work. Dispose-all in the sink. Microwave oven. Clothes washer and dryer. There was a gadget in the kitchen, looked like nothing more than a steel box, and Nick's good friend Ralph Brentner told her it was a trash masher, and you could put about 100 pounds of swill into it and get back a little block of garbage about the size of a footstool. Wonders never ceased. But come to think of it, some of them had. Sitting, rocking on the porch, her eyes happened to fall on an electrical plug-in plate set into the baseboard. Probably so folks could come out here in the summer and listen to the radio or even have the baseball on that cute little round TV. Nothing in the whole country more common than those little wall plates with the prong slits in them. She'd even have them back in her squatter shack in Hemmingford. You didn't think nothing of those plates, unless they didn't work anymore. Then you realized that one hell of a lot of a person's life came out of them. All that spare time, that pleasure which the long-ago Don King had extolled her on, it came out of those switch plates on the wall. With their potency taken away, you might as well use all those gadgets like the microwave oven and the trash masher to hang your hat and coat on. Say, her own little house had been better equipped to handle the death of those little switch plates than this one was. Here, someone had to bring her water fetched all the way from Boulder Creek. Back home, she'd had her own hand pump. Here, Nick and Ralph had had to truck up an ugly gadget called a portisan. They had put it in the backyard. At home, she'd had her own outhouse. She would have traded the Maytag washer-dryer combination in a second for her own washtub, but she had gotten Nick to find her a new one, and Brad Kitchener had found her a scrub board somewhere and some good old lye soap. They would get the power back on, of course. It was one of the things God had shown her in her dreams. She knew a goodish number of things about what was to come here, some from the dreams, some from her own good old common sense. The two were too intertwined to tell apart. Soon all these people would start pulling together. She was not a sociologist like that Glenn Bateman, who always eyed her like a racetrack ticket agent looking at a phony 10. But she knew that people always did pull together after a while. The curse and blessing of the human race was its chumminess. First, they'd want to form some sort of government, probably one they'd want to run around her. She couldn't allow that, of course, as much as she would like to. That would not be God's will. Let them run all the things that had to do with this earth. Get the power back on? Fine. First thing she was going to do was try out that trash masher. Get the gas running so they wouldn't freeze their behinds off this winter. Let them pass their resolutions and make their plans. That was fine. She would keep her nose right out of that part. She would insist that Nick had a part in the running of it, and maybe Ralph. That Texan seemed all right. He knew enough to shut off his mouth when his brains weren't running. She supposed they might want that fat boy, that Harold, and she wouldn't stop them, but she didn't like him. Harold made her nervous. All the time grinning, but the grin never touched his eyes. He was pleasant, he said the right things, but his eyes were like two cold flints poking out of the ground. She thought that Harold had some kind of secret, some smelly, nasty thing all wrapped up in a stinking poultice in the middle of his heart. She had no idea what it might be. It was not God's will for her to see that, so it must not matter to his plan for this community. All the same, it troubled her to think that fat boy might be a part of their high councils, but she would say nothing. Her business, she thought rather complacently in her rocker, her place in their councils and deliberations, had only to do with the dark man. He had no name, although it pleased him to call himself Flag, at least for the time being. And on the far side of the mountains, his work was already well begun. His goal was clear and simple, to destroy all of them. Her understanding of him was surprisingly sophisticated. The people who had been drawn to the Free Zone all came to see her in this place, and she received them, although they sometimes made her tired, and they all wanted to tell her that they had dreamed of her and of him. They were terrified of him, and she nodded and comforted and soothed as best she could, but privately she thought that most of them wouldn't know this Flag if they met him on the street, unless he wanted to be noticed. They might feel him. A cold chill, the kind you got when a goose walked over your grave. A sudden hot feeling like a fever flash, or a sharp and momentary drilling pain in the ears or the temples. But these people were wrong to think he had two heads, or six eyes, or big spike horns growing out of his temples. He probably didn't look much different than the man who used to bring the milk or the mail. She guessed that behind the conscious evil there was an unconscious blankness. That was what distinguished the Earth's children of darkness. They couldn't make things, but only break them. God the Creator had made man in his own image. That meant that every man and woman who dwelt under God's light was a creator of some kind, a person with an urge to stretch out his hand and shape the world into some rational pattern. The black man wanted, was able, only to unshape. Antichrist? You might as well say anti-creation. He would have his followers. He was a liar, and his father was the father of lies. He would be like a big neon sign to them, standing high to the sky, dazzling their sight with fizzing fireworks. They would not be apt to notice, these apprentice unshapers, that like a neon sign, he only made the same simple patterns over and over again. Some would make the deduction for themselves in time. His kingdom would never be one of peace. The sentry posts and the barbed wire at the frontiers of his land would be there as much to keep the converts in as to keep possible invaders out. Would he win? She had no assurance that he would not. She knew he must be as aware of her as she was of him. Nothing would give him more pleasure than to see her scrawny black body hung up to the sky on a cross of telephone poles for the crows to pick. But Would he win? That was not for her to know either. God worked discreetly, and in the ways that pleased him. It had pleased him to let the children of Israel sweat and strain under the Egyptian yoke for generations. It had pleased him to send Joseph into slavery, his fine coat of many colors ripped rudely from his back. It had pleased him to allow the visitation of 100 plagues on hapless Job, and it had pleased him to allow his only son to be hung up on a tree with a bad joke written over his head. God was a gamesman. If he had been a mortal, he would have been at home hunkering over a checkerboard on the porch of Pop Man's General Store back in Hemingford Home. He played red to black, white to black. She thought that, for him, the game was more than worth the candle. The game was the candle. He would prevail in his own good time, but not necessarily this year or in the next 1,000. And she would not overestimate her own place in the game any more than she would underestimate the dark man's craft and cozening. If he was neon gas, then she was the tiny dark dust particle a great rain cloud forms about over the parched land. Only another private soldier, long past retirement age, it was true, in the service of the Lord. "Thy will be done," she said, and reached into her apron pocket for a packet of Planters peanuts. They hurt her gums mortal bad, but my, weren't they tasty. As she munched, Ralph Brentner came up her walk, his hat with the feather in the band cocked back well on his head. As he tapped on the porch door, he took it off. "You awake, Mother?" "That I am," she said through a mouthful of peanuts. "Step in, Ralph. I ain't chewing these nuts. I'm gumming 'em to death." Ralph laughed and came in. "There's some folk out past the gate that'd like to say howdy if you ain't too tired. They just got in about an hour ago. A pretty good crew, I'd say. The fella in charge is one of these long hairs, but he seems well about it. Name's Underwood." "Well, bring 'em up, Ralph. That's fine," she said. "Good enough." He turned to go. "Where's Nick?" she asked him. "Haven't seen him today nor yesterday, neither. He getting too good for home folks?" "He's been out at the reservoir," Ralph said. "Him and that electrician, Brad Kitchener, have been looking at the power plant." He rubbed the side of his nose. "I was out this morning. Figured all those chiefs ought to have at least one Indian to order around." Mother Abigail cackled, spraying peanut fragments from her toothless mouth. "Oh, Ralph, I like you. You're a one." "Why, I like you too, Mother. Anyhow, that fellow Redmond came by. Wanted to talk to Nick about being on some kind of committee." "And what did Nick say?" "Oh, he wrote a couple of pages. But what it came down to was fine by me if it's fine by Mother Abigail." "Is it?" "Well, now, what would an old lady like myself have to say about such things?" "A lot," Ralph said in a serious, almost shocked manner. "You're the reason we're here. I guess we'll do whatever you want." "What I want is to go on living free like I always have, like an American. I just want my say when it's time for me to have it, like an American."
"Well, you'll have all of that."
"The rest feel that way, Ralph?"
"You bet they do."
"Then that's fine." She rocked serenely. Time everyone got going. These people lollygagging around, mostly just waiting for somebody to tell them where to squat and lean.
"Then can I go ahead?"
"With what?"
"Well, Nick and Stu asked me if I could find a printing press and maybe get her going, if they got me some electricity to run it. I said I didn't need any electricity, I'd just go down to the high school and find the biggest hand-crank mimeograph I could lay my hands on. They want some flyers."
He shook his head.
"Do they? 700? Why, we only got 400 and some here.
19 out by the gate, probably getting heat stroke while you and me chin. You go bring them in."
"I will," Ralph started away.
"Ralph?"
He turned back.
"Print 1,000, she said.
They filed in through the gate that Ralph opened, and she felt her sin, the one she thought of as the mother of sin. The father of sin was theft. Every one of the 10 commandments boiled down to thou shalt not steal. Murder was the theft of a life. Adultery, the theft of a wife. Covetousness, the secret, slinking theft that took place in the cave of the heart. Blasphemy was the theft of God's name, swiped from the house of the Lord and sent out to walk the streets like a strutting whore. She had never been much of a thief, a minor pilferer from time to time at worst. The mother of sin was pride. Pride was the female side of Satan in the human race, the quiet egg of sin, always fertile. Pride had kept Moses out of Canaan. "Who brought the water from the rock when we were thirsty?" the children of Israel asked. Moses had answered, "I did it." She had always been a proud woman, proud of the floor she washed on her hands and knees. But who had provided the hands, the knees, the very water she washed with? Proud that all her children had turned out all right, none in jail ever, none caught by the bottle, none of them frigging around on the wrong side of the sheets. But the mothers of children were the daughters of God. She was proud of her life, but she had not made her life. Pride was the curse of will, and like a woman, pride had its wiles. At 108, she had not learned all its illusions yet, or mastered its glamours. When they filed through the gate, she thought, "It's me they've come to see." And on the heels of that sin, a series of blasphemous metaphors rising unbidden in her mind. How they filed through, one by one, like communicants, their young leader with his eyes mostly cast down, a light-haired woman by his side, a little boy just behind him with a dark-eyed woman whose black hair was shot with twists of gray, the others behind them in a line. The young man climbed the porch steps, but his woman stopped at the foot. His hair was long, as Ralph had said, but it was clean. He had a considerable growth of reddish-gold beard. He had a strong face with freshly etched lines of care in it, around the mouth and across the forehead. "You're really real," he said softly. "Why, I have always thought so," she said. "I am Abigail Freemantle. Most folks here just call me Mother Abigail. Welcome to our place." "Thank you," he said thickly, and she saw he was struggling with tears. "We're glad to be here. My name's Larry Underwood." She held her hand out, and he shook it lightly, with awe, and she felt that twinge of pride again, that stiff-neckedness. It was as if he thought she had a fire in her that would burn him. "I dreamed of you," he said awkwardly. She smiled and nodded, and he turned stiffly, almost stumbling. He went back down the steps, shoulders hunched. He would unwind, she thought, now that he was here and when he found out he didn't have to take the whole weight of the world on his shoulders. A man who doubts himself shouldn't have to try too hard for too long, not until he's seasoned. And this man Larry Underwood was still a little green, but she liked him. His woman, pretty little thing with eyes like violets, came next. She looked boldly at Mother Abigail, but not scornfully. "I'm Lucy Swan. Pleased to make your acquaintance." "Glad you could come by, Lucy. Would you mind if I asked, well..." Now her eyes dropped, and she began to blush furiously. 108 at last count," she said kindly. "Feels more like 216 some days." "I dreamed about you," Lucy said, and then retired in some confusion. The woman with the dark eyes and the boy came next. The woman looked at her gravely and unflinchingly. The boy's face showed frank wonder. The boy was all right, but something about the woman made her feel grave cold. "He's here," she thought. "He's come in the shape of this woman. For behold, he comes in more forms than his own. The wolf, the crow, the snake." She was not above feeling fear for herself. For one instant she felt this strange woman with the white in her hair would reach out, almost casually, and snap her neck. For Nadine Cross, the moment was a confusion. She had been all right when they came in through the gate. She had been all right until Larry had begun talking to her. Then an almost swooning sense of revulsion and terror had come over her. The old woman could... could what? Could see. Yes. She was afraid that the old woman could see inside her, to where the darkness was already planted and growing well. She was afraid the old woman would rise from her place on the porch and denounce her, demand that she leave Joe and go to those, to him, for whom she was intended. Two of them, each with their own fears, looked at each other. They measured each other. The moment was short, but it seemed very long to the two of them. "He's in her, the devil's imp," Abby Freemantle thought. "All of their power is right here," Nadine thought in her turn. "She's all they've got, although they may think differently." Joe was growing restive beside her, tugging at her hand. "Hello," she said in a thin, dead voice. "I'm Nadine Cross." The old woman said, "I know who you are." The words hung in the air, cutting suddenly through the other chatter. People turned, puzzled, to see if something was happening. "Do you?" Nadine said softly. Suddenly it seemed that Joe was her protection, her only one. "Yes, I do." She moved the boy slowly in front of her like a hostage. Joe's queer seawater eyes looked up at Mother Abigail. Nadine said, "This is Joe. Do you know him as well?" Mother Abigail's eyes remained locked on the eyes of the woman who called herself Nadine Cross, but a thin shine of perspiration had broken out on the back of her neck. "I don't think Joe's his name," she said, "and I don't think you're his mom." She dropped her eyes to the boy with something like relief, unable to suppress a queer feeling that the woman had somehow won, that she had put the little chap between them, used him to keep her from doing whatever her duty was. Ah, but it had come so sudden, and she hadn't been ready for it. "What's your name, chap?" she asked the boy. The boy struggled as if a bone were caught in his throat. "Come on, Joe," Nadine said, and put a hand on his shoulder. Joe threw it off, and that seemed to break the block. "Leo," he said with sudden force and great clarity. "Leo Rockway, that's me. I'm Leo." And he sprang into Mother Abigail's arms, laughing. That generated laughter and some applause from the crowd. Nadine became virtually unnoticed, and Abby felt again that some vital focus, some vital chance, had ebbed away. "Joe," Nadine called. Her face was remote, under control again. The boy drew away a bit from Mother Abigail and looked at her. "Come away," said Nadine. Now she looked unflinchingly at Abby, speaking not to the boy but directly at her. "She's old. You'll hurt her. She's very old and not very strong." "I love her," the boy said. Nadine seemed to flinch at that. Her voice sharpened. "Come away, Joe." "That's not my name. Leo! Leo, that's my name!" The little crowd of new pilgrims quieted again, aware that something unexpected had happened, might be happening still, but unable to know what. The two women locked eyes again like sabers. "I know who you are," Abby's eyes said. Nadine's answered, "Yes, and I know you." But this time it was Nadine who dropped her eyes first. "All right," she said, "Leo, or whatever you like. Just come away before you tire her." He left Mother Abigail's arms, but reluctantly. "You come back and see me whenever you want," Abby said. But she did not raise her eyes to include Nadine. "Okay," the boy said, and blew her a kiss. Nadine's face was stony. She didn't speak. As they went back down the path, the arm Nadine had around his shoulders seemed more like a drag chain than a comfort. Mother Abigail watched them go, aware that she was losing the focus again. With the woman's face out of sight, the sense of revelation began to grow fuzzy. She became unsure of what she had felt. She was only another woman, surely. Wasn't she? "He comes in more shapes than his own. Wolf, crow, snake, woman." But the thought had no power over her now. "I was sitting here complacently, waiting to be kowtowed to. Yes, that's what I was doing, no use denying it. And now that woman has come and something has happened, and I'm losing what it was. There was something about that woman, wasn't there? Are you sure? Are you sure?" There was an instant of silence, and in it they all seemed to be looking at her, waiting for her to prove herself. And she wasn't doing it. The woman and the boy were gone from sight. They had left as if they were the true believers, and she nothing but a shoddy fake.
Oh, but I'm old. It's not fair.
And on the heels of that came another voice, small and low and rational, a voice that was not her own. Not too old to know the woman is... Now another man had approached her in hesitant, deferential fashion. "Hi, Mother Abigail," he said. "The name's Zelman, Mark Zelman, from Lowville, New York. I dreamed about you." And she was faced with a sudden choice that was clear-cut for only an instant in her groping mind. She could acknowledge this man's hello, banter with him a little to set him at his ease. Not too much at ease, that was not precisely what she wanted. And then go on to the next and the next and the next, receiving their homage like new palm leaves. Or she could ignore him and the rest. She could follow the thread of her thought down into the depths of herself, searching for whatever it was that the Lord meant her to know. The woman is... What?